You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight we've got some pretty good stuff for you. In fact, you're going to be listening to this for about the next six or seven broadcasts. It is the entire audio track from the Legality of Taxes seminar that just took place this last week in Washington, D.C. with some pretty hep people, some of the pioneers in the research of the legality of the federal income tax. So pay close attention. The tape starts about 30 to 45 seconds into the introduction by the master of ceremonies, so you're just going to miss a few beginning remarks, and that's all. The rest of this is all, it's all there. Every single word that was uttered we have on videotape. In fact, if you want to order the two tape set, that's two videotapes, it's over 3 hours of seminar speeches, you can order it directly from us for $20 postpaid. That's both tapes of the entire Legality of Taxes seminar, and you can order by sending $20 in blank money order or cash only. If you fill out that money order, we will not accept it. It's got to be a blank money order or cash only. Send it to the Hour of the Time in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's the Hour of the Time in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Once again, that's the entire two-tape, videotape set of the Legality of Taxes seminar that took place in Washington, D.C. just this last week. If you'd like to order that, it's $20 post-paid. So sit back. Make sure you have pen and paper handy. You're going to want to take notes during this, all of this broadcast, tomorrow night's broadcast, and all of next week is going to be devoted to this particular subject. You're going to get the audio over this broadcast. If you want the video, you can order that from us. So without further ado, here it is, the Legality of Taxes seminar.
The federal income tax and Social Security tax are legal, and if not, what then? The way this came about was that the foundation last winter began to become aware of and to get acquainted with the work and the ideas of a number of people from various parts of the country who have been for years been researching, writing, and speaking out about their beliefs that the federal income tax, as we know it, is not legal and is not being administered legally. It soon seemed like there needed to be an organized meeting of some sort in order to get some of these people together to talk about their work, present it to a concerned audience, compare and contrast their views, and challenge the government to debate with them the key and crucial questions on their merits without evasion. The We the People Foundation for Constitutional Education is an educational not-for-profit corporation whose purpose is oriented towards information, research, and education, and in fact, we are restricted to that realm by our charter. The foundation has not taken a position on the question of the legality of the income tax, except the position that it's a very interesting and important question, and that there's been some very impressive work done on it. We decided that the proper format for the meeting would be in the general style of an academic symposium, combined with opportunity for debate in sort of a point-counterpoint concept. A scholarly format is a good way to assure that the best ideas will float to the top. Since the IRS has chosen not to respond to our request to identify their most knowledgeable people and to have them participate in this symposium to argue against the conclusions of the researchers, we are providing you in your packets, as a substitute, a collection of written arguments that have been used by the government in defense of the income tax. These will be discussed later on, and I'm sure the speakers will be addressing them during their presentations. Now, the overall question of the legality of the income tax is approached at this symposium in terms of two propositions. First, that the 16th Amendment was not legally ratified, indeed was fraudulently declared to be ratified by then Secretary of State Philander Knox in 1913. And two, second, regardless of the 16th Amendment, that there is neither law nor regulation that requires most citizens to file returns and pay income taxes. We recognize that there are a variety of views represented by the participants here and that they don't all see eye to eye on all points. However, the most important common ground is that it appears that they all agree that with the conclusions that most citizens are not legally required to file returns and pay income taxes, and that laws are being applied illegally. We want the speakers to present their ideas and findings in a positive fashion, propounding their own views, not focusing on their differences. That's the job of the government. As I say, we think the best ideas will rise to the top on their own merits. We have, obviously, the question, if the income tax and Social Security tax are illegal, what then? There are many ideas for tax reform. Some of the country's most prominent people have their own ideas in Congress and outside of Congress for tax reform. One of those organizations is the Heritage Foundation. We're pleased to have Dan Mitchell, a senior economist at the Heritage Foundation, with us this morning to discuss with us one such alternative to the income tax, a sales tax. We'll be hearing from Mr. Mitchell later on. So we're here to discuss whether the income tax and Social Security tax are legitimate, or are they a hoax? If a hoax, it's ironic that the first income tax was during the war between the states. Ironic because it was Lincoln who said, you can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. If today's income tax is a hoax, then we don't want to be fooled any longer. And we don't want the rest of the people to be fooled either. We've asked our participants to be as specific as they can in order that the IRS's arguments will have as little wiggle room as possible, and to respond to the government's arguments that way as well. In looking over the government's written positions, it seems like the pea is always under some other shell. We want to eliminate or exhaust all of the shells. That's one of the advantages of having researchers here who have come at this from different angles and backgrounds. Now, we're pleased to have with us as our first speaker, panel member, Bill Benson. Bill Benson in the 1970s spent 10 years as a criminal investigator with the Criminal Investigation Division of the Illinois Department of Revenue. He was let go, fired by the department for uncovering corruption within the department. He sued the state for violation of his First Amendment rights and won a large judgment. He began assisting an attorney in a significant tax case. In June 1983, he was assisting attorney Andy Spiegel in a willful failure to file case. He had 300 documents showing, at that time, serious problems with the 16th Amendment, the so-called income tax amendment, purportedly ratified in 1913. But the judge in that case would not allow Mr. Benson to submit those documents into the record. Undeterred, Bill Benson took then 1 year studying, going to all 48 states, going to the archives of the 48 states that were in existence in 1913, obtaining certified copies of their records, and he determined from those certified copies that, in fact, the 16th Amendment was not properly or legally ratified. It gives me pleasure to introduce Mr. Bill Benson.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for having me here this morning. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I have waited a long time to bring this issue before the cameras, before the courts, in fact, 15 years. As Bob told you, when I was fired by the Department of Revenue for the state of Illinois for undercovering corruption, the director and I did have a very heavy dispute, and I told him I would sue him, and that I did, and won a large judgment against the state of Illinois. So bear in mind, David can beat Goliath. In June of 1983, I began to assist an attorney in Chicago by the name of Andrew Spiegel. We had a willful failure to file income tax case, and we had approximately 300 documents showing that there was a very, very serious problem with the 16th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which gives the government its taxing authority over all of us, over all Americans, to reach into your pocket, reach into your wallet, reach into your bank account, seize your cars, seize your homes, and etc. I hope and pray that I can put this to an end. I am making every attempt to do it, and I did that by going to all 48 states, all 48 continental United States, in 1984, spent an entire year on the road doing nothing but research for the government or against the government. I knew full well, because of my past experience, that if I did not bring back the proper documents, the government certainly would then dispute me, certainly would win. I can tell you now that since 1981, I, Bill Benson, have not filed a personal income tax return. I can also tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that I, Bill Benson, absolutely, completely refuse to file a 1040 tax return if I were given a job that paid me $1 million tomorrow. Because with the research that I did for the entire year of 1984, I came back with 17,000, probably in excess of 17,000, certified, notarized documents showing and proving that the 16th Amendment to the United States Constitution is an absolute, complete, total fraud. And I tell you that I will not file a 1040 tax return because this man is not going to permit the federal government to make him a criminal. For if I file a 1040 tax return under 18 U.S.C. 1001, I become an accessory after the fact to the crime committed by Philander Knox back in February the 25th of 1913, and I refuse to do that. If government cares to come after me and indict me, then let's get the show on the road. That's a purpose for meetings like this. That's the purpose for being on television. I welcome their indictment. I have written a book titled The Law That Never Was. And I believe it's a very, very fitting name. I have a son that went to Vietnam who lost a left leg, came back, and is a computer expert now, teaches computers. We had a problem naming the book. You're writing from the records. You're writing from 17,000 records. That wasn't a very difficult problem. And I said, Gerald, we're having a problem naming the book. He said, Dad, that's very simple. He said, just call it The Law That Never Was, because that's exactly what it is. I will show you a document from the state of Kentucky. This is one of the 17,000 certified, notarized documents that I obtained throughout the 48 state research that I conducted. In this document, it shows on February the 8th of 1910, on page 486 of the Senate Journals for the State of Kentucky, and the government is welcome to look at this, I'm sure they have, because in fact they have a copy. The federal courts in Chicago have a copy of all 17,000 documents, one for a judge and one for a prosecutor. The vote goes on to tell us that there were 9 senators that voted for the amendment and 22 against it. Now, I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, all over this country, when in your wildest dreams or comprehension will 9 ever become greater than 22? If any judge can make that happen, I'll march off to jail tomorrow, or I'll file a 1040 tax return. He can't make it happen. They cannot get by the documentation, and that's why I am as secure with my position as I am. And that's why I can challenge the government as I do. In some of the documents, one of the documents that I found in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., that was authored on February the 25th, 1913, by Reuben J. Clark. He was the attorney for Philander Chase Knox, the Secretary of State at that time. Philander Knox wanted to know how the amendment was adopted. And I believe that his attorney gave him some very good advice, because what he said, in the certified copies of the resolutions passed by the legislators of the several states ratifying the proposed 16th Amendment, it appears that only 4 of those resolutions, those submitted by Arizona, North Dakota, Tennessee, and New Mexico, have quoted absolutely accurately and correctly the 16th Amendment as proposed by Congress. No state legislator can change one word, can change one punctuation. They cannot change capitalization. They cannot change a period or a comma. Because if they do, it does not meet with the requirements of the Congress of the United States, and therefore it must, absolutely must be rejected. I found that to be very true, because when I was researching the 16th Amendment, I also researched the 17th Amendment. In the state of Wisconsin, William Jennings Bryan was then the Secretary of State, and William Jennings Bryan rejected the state of Wisconsin's ratification because they had added a paragraph and changed the wording in the body of the resolution adopted by the Congress of the United States. There were telephone calls that were made back and forth. The secretary made one to the governor. The governor says it's a fortunate thing for us that the General Assembly is still in session, so maybe I can call them back together and we can change it if they want to conform with the wishes of Congress. Otherwise, it will have to be rejected. You see, at that point in time, the legislators for the various states only met once every 4 years. Once every 4 years. Not like today, a profession like they have, and meet once every four split seconds to go ahead and enact some new crazy law for us to be binded by. They go on to also say that the other 33 resolutions all contain errors either of punctuation, capitalization, or wording. Remember the date, February the 15th of 1913. It says, Minnesota, it is to be remembered, did not transmit to the department a copy of the resolution passed by the state. I found that extremely interesting. When I went to Minnesota, I found my answer. And I also found my answer in the 16-page memorandum that any one of you can go to the National Archives and get a copy of. It says on page 16 that the department has not received a copy of the resolution passed by the state of Minnesota, but the Secretary of the Governor has assured the state, the Secretary of the United States, that the amendment has been adopted. The Secretary of the Governor, I beg your pardon, cannot happen, will not happen. The Secretary of the Governor cannot sign a document like this. Absolutely cannot. Has not that power to do so. And it's a good thing for us that they do not have the power to do so. States, ladies and gentlemen, that fail to vote, failed to vote on the 16th Amendment to the United States Constitution, it is still tabled. It's on the table today. There was a 7-year cap on the 16th Amendment, so I give a hang what they do today. They can't vote on it. It makes no difference. Congress likes to give us big arguments. Well, 16th Amendment was brought before the Congress of the United, or before the Supreme Court of the United States, and the argument was lost. Not this argument, not the fraudulent act of Philander Chase Knox has never been before a jury or before a full panel of the appellate court, or with all the 17,000 documents that I possess, the two books that I authored, Volume 1 and 2, has never been brought into district court, ever. You know the reason why? They've got the jury to deal with. And you, ladies and gentlemen, in this room and in this country, are the jury. When will 9 ever become greater than 22? Never. To prove a point, in the Chicago Tribune on January the 10th of 1985, there was a young man that was arrested for selling PCP, angel dust. There's a law that says you can't do this. but the law must be enacted correctly. His lawyer was very, very sharp, very shrewd. He went to the inception of the law, like I did with the 16th Amendment, to find out if the legislative body had enacted that law correctly. And what did he find? He found that an F was substituted for an E in the code, naming a revised section dealing with PCP. The young man flew like a bird. And so did his lawyer right out of the courtroom. They lost the case. Now, I hope you can understand why they fight this 16th Amendment issue as hard as they do. There was a report written on April the 18th of 1980 by the Congressional Research Service. And the Congressional Research Service tells us here in Washington, D.C., that arguably two requirements seem to be legally indispensable in a valid ratification resolution. The first is that the resolution contain in full the exact language of every section of the proposed amendment as it appears in the enrolled joint resolution proposing the amendment. They knew it back in 1913, and they know it to this day. Let one of them in the Congress of the United States, or all of them, pass an amendment to the Constitution, and let the states do what they did with the 16th Amendment, it'll go out the window like that, without a question of a doubt. When I was in Boston, I found more proof. Because, you see, when you're an investigator, when you've gone through court, when you've arrested people, when you've had to prove your case, you better be right, or you're going to get sued. In the report in Boston, there was a question that was asked by the committee. Are we able to change it? And the answer came back by Senator Luce, no, we must either accept or reject it. This was in 1910. Again, Washington, D.C. How our laws are made, extremely, extremely important. Because they must follow. The Congress of the United States must follow the laws as we must follow. If the 16th Amendment were adopted correctly, I would not be standing here before you today and telling you that I will not file a 1040 tax return and permit the federal government to make me a criminal. In the How Our Laws Are Made, it says, each amendment must be inserted in precisely the proper place in the bill with the spelling and punctuation exactly the same as it was adopted by the House. They have got to. Otherwise, what will we have? Chaos. We'd have 48 different versions of any amendment that the United States government tried to have the legislators of the various states adopt. They must do it exactly, precisely, as wished by Congress. In the proclamation by Philander Chase Knox that was written on February 25th of 1913, he said that it appears, when you go into federal court and you argue with the judge, hey, judge, it appears that I'm right and you're wrong, find out how fast you'll go to jail. Or find out how fast you'll get fined. Or find out how fast that judge will do whatever is set in his mind to do to you. It cannot just appear. It must be exactly, precisely as the Congress of the United States wished in any amendment. I wish I had the time to look up all of the amendments. I don't know what I would find. I'm rather afraid to do that. I told you that there were 11 states that failed to vote on the amendment. And in another, I had it put in the back of Volume 1, ratification of the Constitution and amendments of the states presented by Mr. Fess, United States Government Printing Office, ratification of the Constitution and amendments of the states